Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
Today on the Indie Opera Podcast, we have a discussion with Patrick Eakin Young about body opera.
My hope in the end is that this method and this company could become essentially like a crazy compositional machine, something that it's like some sort of weird computer that people can put ideas in and you get all this other stuff out.
Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
And this is Noah.
And this is Brooke.
All right. All three of us are here.
Yay.
So I really enjoyed the last show, making it and editing it and not deleting all the wonderful, funny things you all said.
Can I just say, I just want to pat us on the back. Well, especially you, Peter, but like, I loved the last podcast. I know you're not supposed to say that on your podcast. It's just kind of gross, but I loved it.
Really?
Yeah, I loved it. It was like my favorite one so far.
Well, I learned how to beep things out.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Yes.
I figured it out. We had some really good talks, but of course we said things that we were mega wrong about. So,
well, we're always mega wrong. That's why we have to do another podcast every so often.
So let's talk about something we were mega wrong about.
Okay.
And that was City Opera.
Mm.
And it was me who was mega wrong because I read that all the talks had broken down and I said, there's just no way there's a season. And lo and behold, there is a contract with the unions for at least 3 years. So City Opera, you're on.
But it's not, is it good news? That's the question.
What do you mean?
Well, because it means that the unions are, you know.
Caved.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the that becomes a good question of what are unions for if they're just going to cave. I think it's really great news that they're going to have a season, and I really wanted to see Rufus Wainwright's Prima Donna, and we're finally going to get to see that, and I bought my tickets, and Noah and I are going to go, and we may have to eat our hats, or...
Or oh, I want to eat my hat.
I want you to eat your hat.
Mm-hmm.
I do because I want you to be.
Or what's that movie about the guy? You ever see that movie about when Werner Herzog? He has to eat his own shoe. The whole movie is about him eating his own shoe, but I forget why, because he loses some bet about a movie.
I haven't really seen many Herzog films.
Oh, that's, I don't know. I haven't seen that one either.
Well, I have been threatening to do a movie podcast now that they have the nominations.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, we may take an off from opera and do a movie cast.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So I'm really excited that we're going to get to see this City Opera thing. And I apologize to all those people who said, oh my gosh, there's going to be no City Opera. When like 3 days later, it completely changed.
Yeah, but that's cool. You know, we were wrong and we're wrong forever in history. And that's good.
So now second red mark or second interesting story, Opera Boston. There's more to the story than they just failed because they didn't have money. They didn't just fail because they didn't have money. They failed because of... how do we put this? A cat fight?
Sounds like a cat fight. A combination of poor management choices and on a board level and then some infighting.
All right. So let's get this story out there. It was on Boston.com, an article about what was going on in there. And they have a major donor who really just did not like the artistic director and wanted them out. And it didn't even sound like it was an artistic difference. It just sounded like a personality conflict.
Mm.
And the company was allowed to die. And apparently an earlier one of their music directors was sent away by this same donor.
Richard Conrad.
Now, Ken, should you have an opera company that is being supported by a single income source? How much influence should that income source have upon the work? And then if they decide, you know, that it's going in the wrong direction, if too much relies on that one donor, then you're really messed.
Yeah, but then you have the thing of having more power, probably, if you have a single donor and you get along with them well. I mean, I'd imagine it could be a really good relationship.
It seems like maybe the relationship wasn't maintained on either direction, you know.
But so much rides upon having that kind of relationship with the people that you work with, you know. And it's something I didn't really think was true when I was younger. I kind of thought, oh, I can work with people that are kind of out to lunch, but it's not true. I don't know who is out to lunch, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's I think those kind of interpersonal conflicts can take the whole thing down.
Right. You have to be in the same mindset.
Sure. Yeah. It sounds to me also having read, I mean, just from my reflections on the article and not on anything else, is that there were some fundamental infrastructure problems that made it more complicated, so that they weren't really managing their money well anyway, because of the way the board was sort of operating. So it wasn't just about this one donor, but that things were really, like, they were running kind of hand to mouth, and which is not necessarily a good way to run a business. Right. So, I mean, the problem wasn't just the conflict with this one donor, because if it had just been that, then they could have kind of made it, at least my impressions from the article was that they could have sort of made do. But because there was this one donor who was wreaking havoc and all of these other problems, that's where it fell apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to have that problem, having a major donor. I mean, that's actually,
yeah. He's out there. He's in waiting.
Yeah.
I want Baron von Eschenbach or something.
Yeah. I want that Baron to show up.
Yeah.
I'd like to see if I could manage the relationship, because it is very hard to make artistic decisions, having to satisfy artistic considerations and audience, and then this moneyed support. It's very hard.
Wouldn't that be great, though, if we got calls from the Baron? Oh, Peter, no, our last podcast was so excellent. I'm putting another 8,000 euro in your account tomorrow. We'd be like, oh, this is the best thing ever.
No, the euro's declining, dollars.
I'm putting Deutschmarks in your account.
There we go.
You can't use them. It's tough.
Sort of an additional part of the story that's not mentioned in that article, the music director,
Gil Rose.
Gil Rose actually was just appointed music director of Monadnock Music, which is in my hometown where I grew up.
In Mount Monadnock.
Where we all met.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And that's a summer program that does some amazing stuff. It's what I grew up listening to, and I absolutely love Monadnock Music. So he is not completely out of work. At least he's now got another big thing to deal with, which is great. So I wish Gil all the luck in the world.
Yeah, definitely. Have you heard about this? I just read about this. Tilda Swinton did this thing in Scotland where she put, like, film like a projector screen or something on the back of a truck and basically drove the truck around Scotland, and it was like a movable movable film festival.
Right.
And I was like,
awesome.
This sounds like something Peter would do. Like, put an opera on the back of a truck and drive. You know what I mean?
That's totally.
I think we should do that. That sounds great.
I would do it. I'd sing on a truck.
Sure. So would I.
Yeah.
Anything to bring opera to the people.
Right.
Okay, so that's sort of the two things we had on the last podcast that I'd want to sort of hit.
Errata.
Now, I worked all weekend getting indie opera information into our calendar on our website.
All right.
It's a Google calendar.
Oh, yeah.
But now we have one of the most complete indie opera calendars, at least for the New York area. I want to expand it well beyond that. And I'm looking at February, and it's that we almost have something every single night. And I'm trying to compare it to any other indie opera calendar out there, like there's so many. But there are other calendars, but none that just sort of focus on this sort of work. And so if you want to check it out, go to our website, and you will see what's going on in the next month or two.
Yeah, cool.
Excellent.
Let's talk about what's coming up, just to remind our listeners. Now, give me a second, because I'm actually going to use our calendar.
Looking at it now. Wow.
Isn't that cool? Look at all this stuff going on. There's like three things this Sunday. Some of the things that are on here, which we have never mentioned before. Women on the Verge. Did we talk about this? Opera Manhattan? No. Well, Opera Manhattan's doing Poulenc's one-act monodrama for soprano, Le Voix Humaine.
Le Voix Humaine.
Is it Voix?
Yeah, because it's the H.
Let me say that again. La Voix Humaine. Yeah. Did I say that right?
I think so.
Okay.
Allô, allô, mais non, madame, nous sommes plusieurs sur la ligne, raccrochez. Vous êtes avec une abonnée. Mais madame, raccrochez vous-même. Allô, mademoiselle. Mais non, ce n'est pas le docteur Schmidt. 08, pas 07. Allô, c'est ridicule.
And then they're doing other monodramas by composer Thomas Passatieri.
Yeah, I like him.
Lady Macbeth. And then another one that's called Before Breakfast, based on a Eugene O'Neill play.
I saw a bit of Goethe Dämmerung.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, well, because my friend Heidi was the third Norn, Heidi Melton.
Oh.
And she was incredible. And it was really impressive. And I thought...
We're talking at the Met.
Yeah, the Le Page. And it was. I liked a lot of it, actually. And I liked the set. And the funny thing is people complained about the sets making noise, but I liked it. Kind of creepy to have this big moving semi-creaking sculpture in front of you, you know, and it didn't cover the music, so I was like, nah. You know, I kept wondering if I heard this on a recording, would I be bothered? And I don't think I would, but maybe I'm a weirdo.
would all right, let's get into this. Would Wagner have liked this?
I think we don't have any idea what a man like Wagner would have liked. I mean, Wagner told everybody that he didn't want anyone to clap when the Flower Maidens made their entrance in Parsifal. And then apparently, like, on opening night, he clapped. So who knows, right? He's like, question mark kind of guy. So.
And then did you go see anything else?
I saw The Enchanted Island.
Oh, you made fun of The Enchanted Island last time.
I know, but I saw it.
You went?
I've heard it's great. I didn't like it.
Come on.
I think that they are... I just want to say that the singers... I know this is such old hat thing to say, but the singers at the Met are so good. Even the ones people that are like controversial and whatever, they're amazing. I mean, it was really well sung.
Why did you not want to say that?
Because everybody's... Because they're like they're big brother.
It's okay to...
Yeah, because they're like, you know, they're like the biggest opera house in the world. Of course they have great singers, but... I just didn't. I didn't. I thought that the tempo and the way that the kind of Baroque pulse-driven music was really handled in a kind of flimsy, floppy way, and it was really dumb. I'm sorry. It was really dumb. Like I didn't care about the story. And talk about really bad, really 19th century acting and stage direction. I mean, it was just people clenching their fists and moving their hands, and it just looked like a pageant. It was not. Not my thing. I just didn't like it. But that's just me, and everybody loved it. That was the thing I can say. The house was packed, and people were, like, loving it. So that's good, you know?
Yeah, so I'll put out a plug. It's a pastiche. I'm going to put out for a plug that I know worked. Opera Feroce has a thing called Amor and Psyche, which is an absolute drag-down hootin' time. It's a lot of fun, and it's often done in a cabaret setting, which I really enjoy. So if you see that listed somewhere, go see it.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you see anything, Brooke?
I did have dinner last night with the executive director of Opera Hispanica. Have you heard of this organization? It's based in New York. Their mission is to present Spanish language opera and opera on kind of traditional Spanish
and
themes.
Zarzuela.
And yes. And so they have I can't remember the date. I want to say it's March 16th. They have an event coming up. So you should check out their website. Maybe add that.
Oh my God!
Them.
How have you never heard of these people? This is amazing.
I don't know. How have you never heard of these people?
They're doing something called Siempre Catan, Always Catan. Or I guess yeah, that is Always Catan. Yeah. And that's Daniel Catan. He's like a totally he's getting a resurgence in like now, I would say, in the past 10 years. His stuff is really all
over
the
place. Well, he just died. I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
Kind of rather tragically. I think that's cool. I think that their mission is cool, and I think they're trying to do something that's really unique. And certainly the repertoire is never performed or extremely rarely performed. So that's great, and they're putting together a good team of people.
And it's gorgeous too. I've heard a little bit of like the Florencian El Amazonas, and I've heard a little bit of they're so like melodic and lush, and like they're amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. I'm trying to think what else. I had lunch today with a singer who works with the Remarkable Theater Brigade.
Oh.
Are you familiar with these people?
Yes.
And they do, you know, all new kind of opera on modern themes based in, I think, mostly in New York City. So they're doing cool stuff too. And he's doing something that he referred to as the Big Gay Opera, which I believe is May 18th. I'm not exactly sure what that's about exactly, but he called it the Big Gay Opera, and I feel like it's something that's on, you know, LGBTQ themes. Is that right? Is that the right?
Yeah, sure. Now it's like LGBTQRST. There's like,
is
apparently.
Yeah.
Oh, there's. There are so many different ways of describing every possible permutation of sexuality at this point. It's like, it's amazing.
Yes.
When I was in school, there were like only 3 letters.
Yeah.
They keep adding them.
Right.
Cool.
That's great.
Okay. Well, anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. Well,
that's a lot. I mean, I don't think anybody could go to all of the things that we've talked about on this podcast. Well, unless they were like retired and only went to independent opera events.
Well, you certainly wouldn't be able to go to everything on the Indie Opera calendar because several things are happening at exactly the same time.
Right.
So it's impossible.
Yeah. So that's a good thing.
But if you have events you want to add to our calendar, just send them to me.
And we should also mention on February 16th, the premiere of the opera Truth, which actually we mentioned earlier on an earlier podcast. We had an interview with Paula Kemper, the composer of this opera about Sojourner Truth. It's premiering February 16th up in Northampton, Mass. And for more details, you can check the Indie Opera calendar.
Okay.
And then Prima Donna, as we mentioned, that's actually February 19th, 21st. Actually, the 19th is sold out, so don't bother.
Yeah, this thing is, of course, going to sell out.
Yeah. But the 21st, the 23rd, and the 25th over at BAM.
BAM.
And there's a lot of other stuff going on that you should go and check out our Indie Opera calendar.
The figs are falling from the trees. They are good and sweet. And as they fall,
so I'm here on the line with Patrick Eakin-Young, who is an opera director and an artist originally from Toronto, Canada, and he's now living in London, England. Under the name Opera Erratica, he directs, designs, and produces independent operas from contemporary stagings of Baroque works to underground mashup performances combining early and contemporary music. So welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we're here to basically talk about this idea of body opera.
Yes.
Which I'm going to read what you have here. Which is a new opera technique based on the theater method called viewpoints. Now I know viewpoints. I've heard about it. And now you use both physical and musical improvisation as a tool for training performers, as well as rehearsing and devising new work, which I think is really interesting because viewpoints was developed by
Anne Bogart.
Yeah, Anne Bogart.
And and Tina Landau.
And she taught at what, NYU, I think.
And well, she did teach at NYU. Now she teaches at Columbia, I think, among other places. And Tina Landau used to work for Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago. I don't know if she still does. But they developed this theater technique called viewpoints, which originally comes from this other woman named Mary Overly, who developed it for dance, and they kind of adapted it for theater. And what I encountered it when I was living in New York, and I have been trying to bring it into an opera context. And the challenging thing, or the exciting thing really, is that viewpoints does work with voice in terms of the spoken word, but it's really a physical technique. It's about bodies and space, and but it's also about improvisation and responding to other people in the room and on the stage.
Before we get too deep into this, let's dig a little bit more of a general view. Is that now we're seeing opera up close a lot more often. We're not just seeing them in small theaters, but we're seeing them up close on the movie screen.
And, of course.
And the halls are changing that people are listening to. It's not just these huge opera houses. You know, if you're seeing something in a small theater, it's not going to play the same way. The acting isn't going to play the same way.
People are saying they want to see actors instead of just sort of, walking singing boxes, which has been a lot of what traditionally, you know, people have been talking about. And you can't perform for a huge, 3,000 people opera house in the same way that you can for a close-up, And I think a lot of those close-ups are very unflattering for the performers, and some of these are very good performers who just it's not the same thing. People realize that opera is a dramatic art, and I think small operas, of course, it's like having a permanent close-up. You're always closer. You can see much more. You want to see much more. You want the storytelling to be part of the performance. You want the actors to be performing it. It's funny because I'm not from the opera world. I don't have musical training. When I was living in New York, I was into like experimental theater and making kind of downtown theater pieces. And then somehow I kind of migrated into opera through the first kind of opera-like piece I ever did was a sci-fi rock opera with a full indie band and five dancers that I performed at the New York Fringe Festival.
Great.
And it totally wasn't opera, even though I called it opera. Or I mean, it wasn't what you thought would be opera. But somehow, this idea of kind of musical, visual spectacle, like really, excited me.
Right. Now, the idea of taking the theater point of view and moving it more into opera isn't exactly new. It's been done, like Stanislavski wrote a whole book when he was developing his acting technique on opera.
And I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, Stanislavski on opera, I think is what it's called.
Well, I'm anti-Stanislavski, but I would be interested to read it.
Really? Can you give us, it doesn't matter if it's slightly derogatory, description of what is that technique and what do you have against it?
Yeah, this is great because this, I think, comes to the reason why I'm in, what body opera is all about, in fact. Because Stanislavski is this famous director who invented what's known as the method, sort of the godfather of all acting methods. He was a Russian director in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And he was very much about sort of inhabiting a role psychologically. He was developing his method in conjunction with essentially realist theater, which was, late 19th century realist theater, which was about portraying real people on stage, real emotions, which was getting away from the previous sort of theater style, which was melodrama, which were these kind of heightened theatrical styles. If you look at like that great movie about Gilbert and Sullivan.
Topsy-turvy,
right. That kind of, very broad acting style that you see in that kind of performance. In the late 19th century, they were getting into naturalist, gritty, real dramas.
Right.
Things like Chekhov and Ibsen and things like that. And so he was coming up with an idea that the actor needs to embody and internalize the psychological state of the character, essentially become the character, and then they can perform it.
Right, and that, led to what some people call the American school of acting, which we see a lot of in film and up-close realist films.
Yeah, well, it translates well into film because film is about kind of micro mannerisms. It captures, the camera captures every tiny little detail, and so it, you know, you don't have to change very much to express things.
Right.
And it's a way of channeling or of accessing, you know, performance.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it except that it's 100 years out of date. And of course, it's, you know, it's just like opera to discover Stanislavski 100 years after he was relevant. So, I mean, this is where the derogatory part comes in. I'm sorry. But, you know, it's naturalist theater doesn't make sense anymore. It's, you know, it was a 19th century phenomenon, let alone a 20th century phenomenon. We're now living in the 21st century. So I think, you know, what Viewpoints comes at it, and where a lot of more physical theater methods that really grew out of some of the theatrical revolutions of the 1960s, they discard or they sort of discredit a psychological approach to acting, which is to say that I need to think and be the character in my mind, and then I can be the character on the stage. A lot of these methods come the other way, and they say, I need to physically embody something and the emotions will come out of it, or the emotions will be interpreted by the audience. The point of the performance is up to the interpretation of the audience. I don't have to embody it wholeheartedly. I can just do it.
Okay, so let's set the contrast. It's sort of Stanislavski was an inside out, And a lot of these are more of external in?
Yes, exactly. I mean, for instance, like in the Viewpoints book, Anne Bogart quotes someone, I'm not sure, but I think it might be Descartes or something, who says, you know, like, if you're running away from a bear, is the bear that's making you afraid, or are you afraid because you're running? But essentially, yeah. when you're performing something, if you're crying, is it the act of crying that makes you sad, or do you cry because you're sad?
And Viewpoints would say what?
The Viewpoints would say that it's actually the act of crying
that makes you sad.
Well, or that it's not even important for you to physically be sad, you know, but that there is a sense that you perform the action, you embody it physically, and that generates unconsciously an emotional response that then you can use in your performance.
So what you're concerned with is how the audience reacts and how they fill in the emotional content?
Yeah, the really interesting thing for me in bringing it back to music, bringing it back to opera, is that Viewpoints actually comes out of music. It's sort of intellectual kernels come out of the kind of radical musical avant-garde that was taking place in, just the avant-garde in general in New York in the 60s. People around the Judson Church movement, and particularly Merce Cunningham and John Cage, who were kind of drastic, like radically reorganizing musical value systems by saying that pitch is no more important than duration, and tempo is no more important than that. Every variable in a musical composition is equally important and can equally be manipulable. You know, or Merce Cunningham, for instance, who would choreograph his dances, and then the composer would write the music, and they would never come together until the very end.
Uh-huh.
And it's only through the combination, the sort of these chance operations, and it, which is a very, you know, it's a really sort of conceptual and radical idea. But what it allows you to do is it takes the pressure off of meaning. It makes meaning something that occurs and that is through interpretation and through experience. And that's kind of what Viewpoints is coming at it. I mean, it may make it sound like I'm engaged in some like really weird avant-garde craziness. And that's not the end point. It's just that's the beginning point.
All right. Now, let me just put this out there. I have seen a lot of work where opera companies have gone down the theoretical tube to output performances.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen someone who is very Stanislavski-based do this. And I've seen others that have used other techniques that I didn't quite understand.
Mm-hmm.
And there's varying amounts of success. Now, when I look at your videos, I am very deeply compelled and moved by the performance I saw, though I don't know if the Dido or any of those things were using any of the viewpoint techniques, I found them very moving. While some people who are using other techniques, I go, well, all right, this is a lovely technique. I may believe in it or not believe in it, but it doesn't make a compelling performance.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that the technique is not enough. You know, the technique is a tool to create something, to offer a situation. And this is where I think the City Company and Bogart's Theater Company, that's been using viewpoints for 10 or 15 years or however long they've been working with it, this is their motto as well, this idea that someone like John Cage, for instance, it was the music was the method. It was so caught up in the form of it that you end up getting some music that can some experiences that can alienate people. And the idea with viewpoints is to take this kind of this openness to chance operations, this openness to accident, because this is what improvisation in rehearsal and in composition, that's what it's all about. It's about creating situations where chance can happen.
Okay.
But it's also about training yourself to make the most compelling images and to be the most useful. Because when you, the way that viewpoints works and the way that body opera works in terms of kind of working process is that we train to be able to improvise. But improvisation doesn't mean chaos. Improvisation actually means being able to self-impose limitations,
right,
so that you can get the most useful material out of whatever you're doing.
Right. Now, I did improv theater when I was when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was very young. I found it to be the best training for the stage. I mean, just it makes you to be alive,
mm-hmm,
and present, able to receive what's coming around you and respond to it in a real way instead of anything that's been imposed upon it. I love the idea. Like, do you know Lauren Flanagan? Lauren Flanagan's a wonderful soprano. She sings at City Opera. She uses viewpoints as well with opera singers. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how she does it or what it is. All I can say is that the singers that I have worked with that have gone through her viewpoints training have been incredible artists. They know how to respond to what's being given to them, and they also seem to be very flexible and bring an emotional depth that I hadn't seen in a lot of other singers who are auditioning and who I've worked with.
Basically, what viewpoints as a method, as a performance method, kind of breaks down performance into its component parts. So you have space, for instance, just spatial relationships between two people is one of the elements that you're supposed to, you know, be aware of. Things like body shape or tempo, just the speed at which something is done. And what's interesting about that is it draws your attention to the different elements so that you can be more aware of them. Because everyone falls into patterns and safe zones. And if you just open your mind to think, why am I performing this particular action at this particular speed? What would happen? How would the meaning change if I just did it faster or slower? And that's what, you know, viewpoints at its basic level is about. It's about making you aware of all the different elements of performance. So, I mean, I think opera training does opera singers a great disservice because, you know, opera is a performative medium and there's so little support that opera singers get from their training in terms of how to be present on stage. Right. I mean, that is just the kind of number one thing that they don't learn.
I'm going to be the optimist here. Let's say didn't learn, because every training program that I looked at schools now, they are thinking about this, have thought about it. Not necessarily viewpoint, but I think that at least in New York.
The United States is far ahead of London, I think, and the UK. I think the UK training programs are really, you know, they have like an hour and an hour and a half of acting training a week.
In my day, the hour was called stage deportment, which I truly hated.
Well, that is such a funny way of even...
I know.
Describing it. Deportment.
I know. I remember going to that class going, what does this have to do with performance?
Sometimes it's even optional. You know, you can elect to go to the gym instead of go to your performance training, you know? Still to this day, there's so little emphasis put on just how to be on stage. And that's one of the things that I'm most interested in, is just when people take body opera, one of the things we work in at the very beginning is actually just being, not doing anything, not trying to, act in any way. It's actually just to be on stage, just to be seen, to be open to the audience, which a lot of singers actually have a lot of trouble with.
Right. Now let's talk about the work itself. I watched some of the video, and we'll post links on our website to the video of the viewpoints, which I think is very interesting. What is going on? Are you developing new work there?
That video is it's a bit of an infomercial for Body Opera. That workshop, we were developing exercises and going through exercises with the singers, but then you're also developing new work, and mostly as a as an exercise in and of itself. But the method is supposed to be, I mean, the end goal for me is to develop new work. And I'm interested in training singers, but in a very selfish way, in the sense that the kind of work that I want to make, performers don't exist who can do it yet. And so I'm interested in making a method that will teach singers the kind of working methodology that I want to employ when I make the work that I want to make, which I haven't made yet. And some of that work is at its root is devised opera. And this is the kind of, this is the part where I get a little bit radical, is that I want to use body opera to specifically train an ensemble opera company that it will be a kind of group of singers who are trained in this method, who continue to train, you know, continuously, rigorously with each other, so that they have this connection and they have these tools to be able to create new work through a devised and improvisational process in conjunction with composer and librettist. So I'm talking about starting from a different place when we make opera. Instead of getting a composer and a librettist and maybe a director in a room and coming up with an idea and, you know, hashing out some musical ideas and maybe writing a score or libretto first, I'm talking about getting into a room with the performers and start throwing out ideas in real time and in real space, physical ideas and musical ideas together.
So now, are you just saying, let's try something fast, let's try something, you know, where does the form come from?
In viewpoints, that stimulus comes from anything and everything. And that's what's so amazing about it, is that it opens you up to be responsive to every stimulus in the room. For instance, we were doing an improvisation towards the end of one of my early workshops, and it was just at the point where the performers were really starting to kind of catch on, and they were starting to, you know, because initially it's very, very stressful for performers to improvise, and so the method is all about giving them a little bit of responsibility and then opening it up and giving them a little bit of more responsibility. So putting a lot of restraint on at first, and then eventually they put their own restraint on themselves. So we were doing this improvisation, and the performers were all lined up in this room. One of my performers was looking out the window, and she was watching the street, and there was a baby on the street, and she just started singing, "There's a baby out there." And I don't know where the tune was coming from. It was very simple. It wasn't anything spectacular, but that was enough. A kernel of an idea was, "There's a baby out there." And everybody in the room had been working together enough and had enough kind of experience to jump on that idea and to start turning it into both a musical improvisation and a physical improvisation. And so when I say I want to devise operas with this method, what you do is you get into a room with opera singers who are very good musicians and who are trained in the body opera method. And then what we do is we come up with ideas. We do research, both musical research, listening to things that we're interested in. We do historical research, visual research. We gather all this material together, and it becomes a kind of pot that we can draw on. And then you can do open viewpoints, where open improvisations, where maybe it's up to them to come up with ideas and it's whatever strikes them in the moment. Or you can do kind of more guided improvisations, where you say, let's improvise about a relationship. So let's improvise where it's two against one. So there's two people against one person. Let's see how many different, you know, permutations of that we can have. When you introduce a composer, then his perspective comes into it as well, his or her, I should say. And they can bring in musical ideas, whether it's stuff material that they've written, you know, things, phrases that they're interested in working with, or it can be much broader. So I've worked with a composer who just, he likes sort of concepts. So he says, you know, I'm interested in density. I want to make a piece that is incredibly dense at the beginning and then incredibly sparse at the end. And, you know, you essentially give it over to the ensemble to come up with different ways of doing that. This is all in development right now. I don't have this group of people that can work. If, you know, I haven't been able to make full-length pieces in this way because I'm still finding the performers. I'm still, you know, making the method work. But my hope in the end is that this method and this company could become essentially like a crazy compositional machine, something that it's like some sort of weird computer that people can put ideas in and you get all this other stuff out. And then your job as a director or as a composer, as a librettist, is to edit and to find out, okay, this worked and this didn't work and this worked and this didn't work. And then to, you know, obviously there's an arrangement process. It gets less and less free as you go along. Right. And eventually it ends up as a fixed piece. But it started from a very wild and original place. The hope is that if you start from such a different beginning point, what you'll end up with will not look like what you're used to. And that's the hope.
Well, it's kind of interesting because now, because I'm a structure guy, I love structure. It's kind of interesting that we originally started talking about how taking an external structure and letting it inform the inside. But the way you're composing the piece is by starting with improvisation, which is sort of the inside of it, and then building a structure around it on the outside. So it's very interesting how the outside's informing the in and vice versa.
I think it's a really interesting sort of analysis of it, of the way in which the inside and the outside are influence each other. The step that I'm taking, which is a bit weird, is that I'm saying, don't only improvise physically, improvise musically, you know? And that's the bit where people often kind of go, and that, actually, that's the bit that I don't know about. Right. You know, Viewpoints has been around for 20 years, and people love it, and people have been working with it. You know, it's not for everybody. But to turn it into a musical process is something that I don't know whether that's going to end up.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that makes me go, oh, boy. Just because I love composers and I love, it's almost like reality TV. In opera form, it's like I don't want you to be improvising in front of a camera.
The thing is, it would never be improvised. It's never about performing improvisation, unless, of course, you know, a composer puts it in the score that you can improvise here, kind of thing.
But still, reality TV isn't either. They edit it and change it.
No, of course.
You know what I mean? I always go, what kind of theater is this going to make now? I don't think that it's not worth trying, or it just makes me go, wow, there's something, it's a huge question mark, because you need a very special composer who can live in that universe.
Well, it would be, you know, it depends. I think different composers could use it in different ways. That's the thing. It's like to work with this this hypothetical company would be, you could come in and you could use it just as like a way of generating ideas, you know, that you could just test things out and say, someone's told me that Bert Whistle, when he writes his operas, he gets into a room before anything with actors and just kind of just improvises scenes with the actors, just to kind of see what dramaturgically, like what could be going on, you know? So you could have people come in and just say, I want to try this out. And you could try that. Or you could have them bring in a whole bunch of source material and throw it into the pot. And then it bubbles out in all these different ways. And the hope is that through accident, you come into something really interesting. The funny thing is you know, I'm a director, and directors are all about control. And all my work up until now, basically, up until this, has been, you know, involves a lot of video projection and has been really sort of low budget. So I've had like a week to rehearse with my performers, you know, and everything has to be set ahead of time because I need to make the video, you know, months ahead of time. And so everything has been so constrained. And I think a lot of opera happens like this because it's such a huge beast that you need to know what's going to happen because you can't waste any time. And so body opera for me is like this idea of not knowing. I don't know what's going to happen. You get into a room with 10 people and you have no idea what's going to come out. And there's something like, I don't know if it's like a masochistic tendency in me, but that really, it's like really exciting to do that, you know?
Yeah. I think that there's also personalities that bloom in that. And there are personalities that bloom in being told what to do. Tell me what to do and I will do it.
Well, that's, I mean, I find it, as a, you know, as a stage director, that is the majority of singers. You know, they want to know exactly where to stand and and how to say it.
Where's my light?
Right, exactly. And I think that's also where like divaism comes from in the opera world, in that there's a kind of disempowerment of performers. And so the only way that performers can kind of exercise control is through misbehaving or being, you know, divas, essentially.
I would, that is that a diagnosis, psychological?
Yes, definitely. Because, you know, if you don't have any agency, you know, like a child, if you don't have any agency over what you're doing, the only thing you can really do is to kind of block what to not do what you're expected to be done, you know? I mean, singers really don't have a lot of control over their lives because they go to auditions and somebody else either hires them or doesn't hire them. They have music directors who say it has to be this way or it has to be that way. Same with, you know, actors. A lot of times there's a real sense of disempowerment, and I'm interested in empowering singers because I think that if you have more confident performers, you have better performances.
What is your goal? 2 years?
Well, my goal is I'm running another workshop in April with some performers who I've already worked with, in order to kind of delve deeper into the process. And then I'll probably do another one in August, which will be for new performers. And my goal is by 2013 to start to make short pieces with composers and show them in interesting and different ways. And until I have maybe 4 or 5 different short pieces, and then maybe I'll perform them all as a kind of, a production or an evening of performances of short pieces as a way of getting people interested in the method. My long-term goal, the first major work that I want to make with this method, is I want to do an adaptation of Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. this is a project I've been thinking about for years, that I want to make an opera out of Thus Spoke Zarathustra.
Talk about setting a big goal.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, and it would start with Thus Spoke Zarathustra, but it would end up, I mean, who knows where it would end up.
Right. Well, you know, I wish you all the luck and all the talent. I hope you come and take part.
They should definitely check out my website, and there's a mailing list they can join, and they can select that they're interested in workshops. And because I'm always interested in getting, I mean, one of the things is not everybody's going to want to work this way. And so I need to find the sort of kindred spirits out there who are interested in engaging in something new.
Great. Well, you know, it has been pleasure talking with you, and
thank you. Been a pleasure too. We didn't even get to discuss how much I like your podcast.
Oh well, we can take that off air.
I mean, I think that just, you can put this on your podcast, because I think that I think indie opera, obviously I make indie operas, but I think that it is the way forward, and I think certainly I think it's the life of new opera, and I think that you promoting it on the internet is a great idea.
Well, I think there's a lot of energy behind it, and we'll see where it goes. All right, see ya.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, so now
that's... He's got a great accent.
Yeah, he's from Canada.
Yeah, it's a nice accent, though. It's really, like, gentle and cool. It's a good one.
But a lot of issues come up with this.
Well, first off, I want to say that I can only speak, like, kind of to my own experience. I've done very little acting, but I've done, you know, mostly acting in opera, and I've had very little training in acting, mostly in college. But I always really thought, I'm like an outside-in guy. Like, I don't like the idea that actors need to whip themselves into an emotional frenzy in order to get their work done. Like, I'm much more into the idea that acting is a craft, and that you can, if you're really great, you can put it on and take it off.
It just sounds like such a betrayal to me as an audience member. Like, I want them to be feeling what I'm feeling, you know?
I think that they're feeling something better. I mean, as just from the point of view of an actor, like you guys, when we did Our Town, and, you know, I had to do the whole thing with my wife dying and then the funeral thing, and, like, I was definitely moved in those moments when it was really good, on the nights, you know, where it was really cooking, and the moments that it was really great. But I wasn't moved because of the story, or I wasn't, like, lost in the story. I was moved because of, like, what we were doing on stage. So it seems like that's outside, and that creates an impression inside. So it's outside in. Rather than me, like, suddenly losing myself and really believing that I'm an 18-year-old dude whose wife died. Like, that seems like an insanity, willed insanity to me.
What do you? I agree. I'm the same. I have a similar. I'm not really a method actor. As it were.
Right.
What is the training here in the U.S., let's say, for opera singers now? What do they teach acting this way? Or
I think it's a mix. I think it's just as varied as the landscape of acting study is, right? Like, there's people who think and do all sorts of different things, and everybody says that everybody else is talking nonsense. just like teaching voice, right? Everybody's voice teacher is a hack, except for yours.
Yeah. Right. I actually don't think that's true. I think everybody's trying to get to the same place, and the method by which they get there, it may differ. But the end result, hopefully, is some semblance of something similar.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think actually it's funny because all of this work goes into acting, and then really the judgment of it is really so simple, right? It's like, oh, that works, or that it doesn't.
Same with vocal technique.
Yeah, exactly.
So then have either of you ever done any of this viewpoint stuff?
No, but this job that I have now teaching in the Bronx, I was gonna say we should bring this guy on that I teach with in the Bronx, because he hasn't directed any opera, but he's done a lot of theater, and his name's Javier Gonzalez, and he's amazing. And most of the work that I've seen by him is with kids, but the stuff that he does with kids, especially last year, is a much more on the side of it sounds a lot more like this viewpoints thing, in the sense that he really tries to use improvisation and to create ideas, and really uses physicality and space and all of these things that are external that everybody has access to in order to get something interesting going on.
Does it make good theater?
It is amazing. The stuff, I've never seen anybody do things with young actors that are this powerful. I mean, just very simple things, but just absolutely amazing. I mean, one of the examples I can give is, like, at the last sharing of last year, he had his entire junior class, like, do this thing that was, like, they all started on the right side of the stage, and then there was a gunshot fired, and they all ran, like, in this kind of, like, race, but very slow, almost in slow motion, and then, like, the formation of the race, like, got different, you know, the shape of the race changed, and then each of the kids started to fall very slowly, and they all kind of crumpled into this perfect shape and this perfect pile, and it was so affecting and so moving and so much about, like, what theater is good for, which is, you know, the fact that you're in a room with somebody, you're in a room with bodies, and you're in a room with people who are real, and it just made use of that so well. I just thought, this is nuts that these kids are in high school. You know,
that's great.
Yeah.
I'm trying to form a cogent thought.
No, but anyway, so, like, I thought it was interesting. I agree, I think, ultimately with what he thinks about acting. But at the same time, I'm a little bit uncomfortable just dismissing somebody like Stanislavski. And the other thing is, he said that was what worked 100 years ago, and realist theater does not work nowadays. And to me, it's like, but realism in many of its forms and Stanislavski keep coming back.
Right.
So there's something going on with that kind of thinking that's valid, because it keeps coming back.
Yeah, I don't think you should just dismiss it. I mean, if you're going to dismiss something because it's 100 years old, then we have no careers.
Opera. Right. What are we doing?
But I think he dismisses it for a good reason. And I think that reason is because this guy has obviously found something that really works for him and that he can use. And he's got a way.
Yeah.
And so that's great.
Right. My impression is that anything that brings a performer closer to themselves, any opportunity to dig deeper into their own stuff, can make them more authentic and generally just better on stage and better people, which makes them more interesting to watch. And so anything that will allow somebody in is useful. it'll be interesting to see how those workshops then turn into performance.
Exactly.
That, you know. So there's theory and then there's practice.
Yeah, I'm intensely curious because I trust this guy. I like the work that he has produced outside of this theory.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I you said the word trust. I have not seen this guy's work, but trust is a word like, you know, you hear him speak about it and you're like, uh-huh, this guy knows what's up.
Yeah, but it's also, he didn't swallow the Kool-Aid. Like, he hasn't decided that this must work and that it will produce great things. He's coming from the position of, let's see if that's what happens. Which I really appreciated because it's so, a lot of people who sort of go along this route, like, we're going to try this experiment. They're sort of so convinced that it's going to work that it actually gets in the way of it ever actually working because you already have a preconceived notion of what it will be.
Mm-hmm.
He seems really sort of open to the idea that it might fail. And I love that. That should be the position of the artist or the composer.
Yeah, you got to be brave. That's George Crumb was at Eastman once and it was awesome. He had like a hunter coat on and he just acted like your grandpa. Like he started talking to you like you were like most people. Like he just started talking to people like he knew them for a million years, you know. And one of the things he said to the audience, like at one of his little audience chats, was he's just like, you know, I think you need to be a little bit stupid to be a good composer. I just thought that was such a brilliant thing to say because I don't think he means you have to be deficient. I think he means that you have to be brave, and part of being brave is being like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to try this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know?
Well, I think that, I mean, doesn't that apply to life? You kind of have to just go and hope for the best.
No, yeah, that of course.
Yeah.
But I think we're so afraid of people falling. I mean, the way parenting is done today, it's like we're so afraid that our kids might take a step that might lead to failure that we don't even let them take the first step, you know?
I think we could bring this all under an umbrella.
Okay.
I think so, because I was fascinated with the fact that he mentioned Descartes.
What do you mean?
Well, because Descartes is an important thinker in philosophy, but he did one thing that really, we're pretty much in philosophy, everybody's trying to get over it. Like the 20th century, if you can draw a narrative for it, uh-huh. It's trying to get over one thing that Descartes did.
And what is that one thing?
Well, Descartes proposed that there is a kind of internal state that we have, that an impression that we have of the world that's very much out of sync with what the reality is.
Okay, and we're trying to get away from that thought? And
I think so. I think both the fact that we believe in reality and that we don't believe that the Matrix is going on and that, right? I don't know. Because nothing's really real. I mean, that to me seems like insanity. And that's where, if you go with Descartes, with the idea that we could all be being tricked all the time, then you end up being a skeptic and being suspicious of your own ability to make sense of the world.
Right.
Well, and that's why I think we are trying to get over him.
Absolutely.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we had a contest and we played a clip and I knew it was going to be impossible for people to answer and we got no guesses. Nobody guessed. So now my question is, should I play another clip from the same thing that's a little easier or should we give it away and try something different?
I think we should give him another chance.
Okay.
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay, maybe this will help.
I think if they don't get it this week, we should just give the gift to Brooke.
Yeah. All right, so I'll play another clip. And
we never said exactly where to email, so you should send your guests to comments@indieopera.com
and guess what this clip is. So let me play another clip.
I could make no sense of what I've seen in terms of conventional neurology. How could a professional musician, a practicing teacher, mistake his wife for a
All right. So now let's do some of the closing show business.
Cool. Should we talk about?
Well, we've got. I just want to put out there that someone said, have you ever asked for money, you know, for donations? And I was like, well, you know, we haven't really done that in a while. So we actually do have a donations page where you can go and help us support this wonderful endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to encourage especially those with some disposable income.
And we promise we won't, like, spend it on champagne. anything like that. Well, you know, like too much champagne.
If they gave us a ton of money, I'll spend my own money on the champagne. Yeah.
That's good.
But also we want people to send information about the projects they're doing. We've gotten a bunch recently and we're going to try and follow up on those. We can't actually get everything onto the show as, you know, I wish I had weeks on end to do this. But there are some projects coming up that we're going to be doing interviews on from suggestions. And as a matter of fact, this particular podcast, with Patrick Eakin Young was actually a suggestion.
Are actually one of our, my cousin-in-laws, is that the thing? Cousin-in-law? Can you say that?
Sure.
Is actually like not into opera really. Well, I guess he is now because he really, really likes our podcast and he keeps telling me that he's listening. And actually he wrote me a little Facebook message that he played the last podcast at a party and they, like, and there was a crowd of people listening and they were laughing. And it, so that's awesome.
That's fantastic.
I just wanted to say I was like really warmed by hearing that, you know.
Amazing. So.
Well, we didn't swear at all.
Yeah. I mean,
we can.
No, we can't. Peter made us like Nick Jr.
No, I liked it.
Because, no, it makes sense, though. I understand why.
It's Nick Jr. I kept them in. I just beeped it out. We're like the Daily Show.
Yeah, the Daily Show. That's right. Not Nick Jr.
I want to put out the idea of people who want to be contributors who have the ability to do some reporting or to do things like that to let us know. We want to thank you for listening.
All right. And that's all from me, Noah.
And me, Peter.
And me, Brooke.
That's good.
Thanks for listening.
All right.
Bye.
Got Stitcher? We are on it. So get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.